Welcome back to the KingCast, here on the Fangoria Podcast Network. I'm Anthony Bresnikan.
I'm Eric Vespi.
We're a little less upbeat today because this is an encore episode of the KingCast from several weeks ago, a few months ago. I lost track of where I am in the space-time.
Yeah, it was last year. I remember recording this almost around this time last year, I think, because I was traveling and I did it in a hotel room, I remember.
That's right. But we got news over the weekend that Chuck Russell had passed away. He was on to talk to us about his new version of Witchboard. He was the director of Nightmare on Elm Street 3, The Dream Warriors, and directed The Blob. He collaborated on both of those with longtime King adapter extraordinaire Frank Darabont. He was also the director of The Mask and Arnold Schwarzenegger film Eraser, which I kept to say I didn't see that one, but I've seen The Scorpion King and quite a few of his other films. He was a fun character. They found him. He had passed away. How old was he, Eric?
74, I believe. I mean, it's you know, the age where it shouldn't be surprising, but it also 74 now feels kind of young.
Yeah.
I know when I was, a kid, hearing somebody died at 74 was just like, well, of course they did, but... But these days, 74 is a little young. And especially when we talked to him, he was one of those kind of full of life people. But as we both experienced in our life, death doesn't really discriminate and comes and will hit you no matter how upbeat you were the week before. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah, and look, the KingCast is a celebration show. It's because we love Stephen King and his books and his stories and his credit card commercials. But like, we, part of life is losing life. And we've talked about that a lot with regard to Scott's passing and, death of Rob Reiner. And now with the passing of Chuck Russell, it seemed like a good idea to bring back his conversation with us from last year. Again, it seems pretty fresh in my memory. It feels like it wasn't that long ago, but I guess it was, and now he's gone. But we have this to remember him by, so I guess we'll... here's our encore presentation of the KingCast conversation with the late, great Chuck Russell.
Yeah, rest in peace, Chuck. Thank you so much for coming on the show. Thank you so much for everything that you've given us. And listen to this in remembrance, and then go watch The Blob. I just want to say that real quick. If you haven't revisited it in a while or you've never seen it, it's obviously Nightmare 3 is one of the best in the series, but The Blob in particular, it's the kind of fun yet mean-spirited movie that I love so much about like 80s horror output, and you don't get movies like The Blob very much anymore. You want to see some kids get eaten by a blob, go watch Chuck Russell's version.
It is a 1950s style with 1980s aesthetics, and it is the best possible blob movie.
So rip to a real one. Fangoria has been at it for over 40 years, and it is better than ever. This magazine, it's not only gorgeous, it's highly collectible, and delivered right to your front door 4 times a year, each issue filled to the brim with articles exploring every nook and cranny of genre filmmaking, past, present, and future, with all the most exciting journalists, filmmakers, and horror know-it-alls to guide the way, including little old me from time to time. This high-quality writing will only ever appear within the physical pages of the magazine, so if you want to join in on the fun, you're going to need to subscribe, and in order to do that, all you got to do is head on over to Fangoria.com and sign up. If you use the code KingCast at checkout, you will save a ginormous 25% off of your subscription. That is Fangoria.com, code KingCast. Now on with the show.
Hi. My name is Stephen King.
He's gonna break!
Bad Rob! You guys
wanna
go see a dead body?
Well, sometimes that is better.
Hello and welcome back to the KingCast on the Fangoria Podcast Network. My name is Eric Vespi.
I'm Anthony Bresnikan.
And we are your hosts. Our guest today is one of the best genre directors of his generation. He gave us not only one of the best horror remakes of all time, he also gave us one of the best Freddy Krueger films. Maybe some would say the best Freddy Krueger film. I might be in that camp. And that was before he helped launch Jim Carrey into the stratosphere. He's a writer and director behind The Blob, A Nightmare on Elm Street 3, Dream Warriors, The Mask, and he has a new, more brutal take on the fabulous 80s cheese fest Witchboard, which sees release August 15th in a theater near you. His chosen title is, appropriately enough, given his creative collaborations early in his career, The Shawshank Redemption. We'll dive into all that and more. Please welcome Chuck Russell to the KingCast.
Welcome, Chuck.
Glad to be here. Thank you for having me.
Oh, Chuck, man. Eric, I need to add something to his to the excellent intro you made for him. This is the gentleman who gave us Cameron Diaz.
That's true.
Did you not discover her? Isn't that her first movie, The Mask?
The discovering part is always an odd. As if I'm Christopher Columbus. That was a classic Hollywood search, though. It's true. A very old school to find a lead girl for that movie. Because I was convinced we needed to introduce somebody new. And I had studied all the old Marilyn Monroe's introduction, different big female lead introductions. And Cameron was amazing, but she had never acted before. So I come from theater and I have the craft part gives you guidance on situations like this. Because from the very first time I had a read with Jim Carrey, Jim was better in those readings. During the audition process as Stanley Ipkiss. So there was a real chemistry between the two. And I fought hard to put Cameron in the movie because the studio, and rightfully so, they were concerned about a female lead that hadn't done it before. But I shot every scene with her and Jim. I taped it that would go into the movie and it was wonderful and took some of the doubts away. And there you've got Cameron, who's one of the most charming and talented. And there's an element of courage in any form of acting, and she has that courage. So she was a wonderful choice and really helped make the movie special.
You gave her quite an introduction. I still remember sitting in the theater and watching her walk into the bank. Right? Isn't that the first we see her?
I put all the pressure on myself on that first shot. Remember Marilyn Monroe and the iconic shot with her over an air vent at the street or something with her. But I didn't want to make it obviously sexual.
No, it wasn't. It's just her walking in and you're like, wow, striking.
A beautiful woman in a vulnerable moment where she's coming in from the rain. She's fixing her shoe. That's the first moment you see her in the film. And I did a thing where we wasn't digital. We had film, so we had to pull film speed while we were shooting it to go into slow motion to get Jim's big reaction. Of course, there's Jim looking sideways at this beautiful girl and really made it work.
It is an overly sexualized. It's her eyes. It's her smile. It's her expression. It's the charisma.
You literally fall in love with her. There's a girl next door element to the ideas.
Sure. But it's that movie star thing where just all eyes turn toward whoever the movie star is.
Why I keep doing this? There's a magic. You can catch lightning in a bottle, and in that case, that was truly the best experience I had with catching something the audience has never seen before.
Has the statute of limitations lifted on who the studio wanted you to push? Was there a bigger name that they wanted?
Weirdly, it was a sideways name to me because it was a TV star. Was somebody who was well known at the time, and I had nothing against the actress, but it would to take a familiar face and say, this is a girl, the good guy and the bad guy are killing themselves for, but it's a familiar face who was not known as an iconic beauty, but an attractive actress, was a big burden to me. And I said, you got it. This is the CGI is new. Jim Carrey's a new star. You know, I've got to have somebody new in this part so I can believe, that the villain and the hero are going jumping through hoops to get her attention. Cameron did it quite naturally, and there's people ask me, how did you find somebody so pretty? It wasn't just the look. The world's full of beautiful people. It's that inner charm, the kind of magic that is Cameron, that is hard to describe, but she definitely has it.
You need somebody who has a little bit of grit in there too, because this, you know, at the end of the day, there's like, it's a gangster background to this comic book movie. Right?
Cameron's heritage is Cuban. So she may look like the all American girl, but she has a little sizzle to her. And It's just all part of her personality.
I can tell you don't want to name names, right? But I can guess it from the context clues. Estelle Getty.
I'm not gonna admit to it because it's rude for me to kind of say I desperately didn't want any one particular person. Mm-hmm. The truth is they didn't really even understand what I was doing at the time, the studio, right. But they were had enough faith in me to let me run with it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's I'd excellent. Say that the mask has another distinction for me. I mean, listen, I was part of the audience back then. I saw that movie in theaters. I remember seeing the trailer for the first time before a movie vividly. It really hit me. But the important thing, the thing that will always be a landmark, I'm a physical media collector, and the very first DVD I ever owned was The Mask, and it was the one that came with the DVD player when they released in 1997.
I have good news for you.
Yeah.
As to where I was on Monday in Burbank remixing the mask after I've already done colorization for it in a brand new format. It's some kind of big new D. I think it's 8K DVD release, and it looks and
8K.
Sounds, yeah. Well,
wow.
I'm a little confused because I had to run in while I'm doing all the work on Witchboard's release. Right. But it looks amazing. Of course, we shot it on film,
right.
And this is a big redo in with all the best tech in the digital world. And I'm telling you, I rediscovered it myself. It looks great, and all our original music and sound effects are wonderful. Milo the dog's little whimpers, we had to get just right again because it was a complete remix. So that's coming out, I think, relatively soon.
Oh, wow. No, I'm very Excellent. Excited for that. I'm definitely here for the 4K or above revolution as we keep
weirdly,
anything that keeps movies off of the compressed streaming platforms and into your homes, I'm happy with.
Kudos to Warner's New Line because I just did the same thing for Elm Street 3 out of nowhere. They're doing a complete set.
Right.
So I'm delighted that films of mine from that many years ago still have a life and still entertain people. That's really exciting.
Great. Well, that's a really great segue into my first question, where we talk a little bit about your new movie. Before we started recording, we were talking a little bit about the corporatization of the online blogging world and how you've noticed that, in your industry as well. I couldn't help but compare The Blob, which is a movie that freaked me out when I was younger. It's a movie that still freaks me out. I love that movie. I love that it's unflinching. I love that it will kill a kid. I love that there's just a lot of intelligence to what could essentially just be a goofy, cheesy update to a goofy, cheesy movie. Now you're coming to us with Witchboard, which, I don't think a lot of people outside of like the huge 80s horror hounds, kind of know this movie, but it is something that could have been very cheesy, but it feels like your approach is a little similar where you're acknowledging that, yes, it's kind of an out there supernatural premise, but you're going to ground it a little bit. It's not a Ouija board anymore. It's, it's something that could actually feel like a witch would use, things like that.
We went into, thank you for that. It's a compliment. Yeah. And by the way, since you're Stephen King centric.
Mm-hmm.
That's my big take on Stephen King from the first short story of his I read, which I can't remember which one, but the King always wrote in the characters' heads and in the events.
Right.
I always felt like it's a trick I do when I'm writing anyway, which is it's like hypnotizing a chicken. What if there really was a vampire? How would that work in my neighborhood? What's the darker but more realistic human reaction to that kind of thing? Which I tend to do in my horrors for my own sake. And I love taking a important piece of pop culture, which I believe Witchboard also is, just like The Blob. It's resonant, it's fun in its cheesiness, but what if we did it today and what if we just blew it up? Mm-hmm. I'm not trained in doing a remake. In fact, I don't consider either of those remakes. They're really a true reinvention where I'm bringing something new to the audiences based on a classic idea. I love doing that. I had fun doing both The Blob and Witchboard and going crazy, taking the premise to the nth degree.
Mm-hmm. I love the historical side of Witchboard, where you take it back to the distant past and witches and Wiccan and healers of centuries ago.
It's called Witchboard. And I was actually doing notes on a Pendulum Board movie because I'm fascinated with the audiences may know not much about pendulum boards, but there's a historical reason they don't, because the French Pope outlawed them in the 1700s, and people didn't talk about them, or they get burned at the stake. Women were burned at the stake for having pendulum boards, which include a pendulum and a lot of sacred symbiology, astrological science, things like this, and they predated the Ouija boards. I thought, well, what if I really did a witch board and got into the real history of witches, which I think, while the film is wild and the effects are some of my favorite that I've shot, there's a resonance to what happened to the Queen of Witches back in the day and how it affects Madison Eisman's character in this picture.
Eric, should we remind people who might not know what the original Ouija board, what the premise was?
Sure. Yeah. No,
I
this I revisited both, or not revisited both. I saw yours for the first time, Chuck, and then I went back and watched the original because I don't think I'd seen it since maybe some cable rotation back when I was like
think
10 years old or something. And I
this
keep
was made, that movie was made for USA up all night.
Yeah, totally.
Right down to Tawny Kitaen as the
The main thing I remembered was because back in the
her
day,
hair.
Tawny Kitaen was an MTV star, an amazing
Right.
gal, and there was a shower scene that was extremely memorable in that movie.
Yeah,
Very
and I noticed
memorable.
that you there's a you said you reinvented, and you absolutely did, and there's like a couple of key callbacks, and I noticed the shower scene made
Of
it. I
course, you
mean,
can't do it without people who saw it for the first time said, "Wow, I guess that's a your homage to Hitchcock." I go, "No, you must not have seen the
the
original."
original.
What
So
was
let's say
the
there's a party scene. You got the house party. You've got
right.
that too. But the
Up the
where?
love triangle. There's a love triangle in the original, two guys and a girl. I flipped it just to have some fun with that, and it's two girls fighting over a guy. So there are several nods to the original, but mainly to the resonance of the original, to the spirit of the original. So it's terrifying, but it's fun.
There's a
Well,
house. So the house party, they try out a Ouija board, and one of the smug part of that love triangle makes sure everybody knows it's Ouija, not Ouija. And then there's a workplace accident where that brings us our first big death. It's a different workplace in your film.
She's lost the ring. She's lost the wedding ring.
She's
That's
lost the
true. So
ring. That's the
that's
same
plenty
thing.
to be
It's
honorable.
helpful. Right.
You've got the
Yeah, I
shower
mean,
sequence, but then okay, Garrett, go ahead. I'm
but
stepping
the
on.
originals is a little bit more of a kind of like a trickster. You kind of it's set up as they're talking to like the spirit of a 10-year-old boy, and that spirit does exist, but it's being kind of poltergeist style, like muscled out by a big evil entity that's impersonating this child and becoming more and more real to Tawny's character, who is navigating the board and kind of bonding with this spirit, which turns out to be the malevolent spirit of a long dead serial killer, hacker, murderer guy who then, ultimately wants to take over her body. But Chuck, what you do that's differently here, or that's different here, is that you kind of, you talked a little bit about it. You leaned into the historical witchiness, and you gave some real depth to the entity that's kind of behind this. That's,
You know,
you know, you
I
kind of she deserves. It's like the Bride in Kill Bill. She does deserve her revenge,
that's the
despite
fun
what you
of it.
feel about the new characters.
I think the best antagonists in movies are ones where we understand they'll not stop and why. So it also I just wanted to do things I'd not seen before in the genre. It's the whole reason I did another horror film, is I wanted to do everything I hadn't done in the genre, I hadn't seen in the genre, and bring it to this particular film. And I'd seen so many witches where the most you got was, well, they hung her on the tree that day or whatever. And there is an amazing history to Wicca and to witches where they were terribly oppressed, mostly obviously innocent. I think there were probably real witches or warlocks that were manifesting evil back in the day and got caught, but 90% of them were innocent victims who were a single woman at the wrong time in history. Or even practitioners of homeopathic medicine the church didn't like. So I mean it's that shit's deep, and I thought resonant. And the key line, not to do too much of a spoiler, Antonia Despas, who plays our witch, who's an amazing French actress, so you'll see more of, I think, in her career, she's great, is a moment where they're stoning her to death, and she says, "If it's a witch you want, it's a witch you'll get." And you realize where a lot of that comes from. So I really got a kick out of that turn of the story. It was one of the reasons, one of the things when I sketch out a story, what I'd like to do, that I thought, okay, I'd love to do this movie. I also didn't want to do a typical possession movie. I took it way further into parallel time frames that I had a lot of fun with. So I don't want to give too many things away, but
Yeah. I would love to dive into that, but that because that's probably my favorite aspect of the story. But we're talking late third act stuff here, folks. So if you're going to watch the movie, you'll
we get
understand when you
down.
get there.
I will say this much. There's no flashbacks in this movie, as far as I'm concerned. There's a parallel time frame where what Madison Eisman's character does in the contemporary world is actually affecting the timeline in the 1700s. Point where we really go deep in both directions. I just wanted to flex my muscles cinematically, visually, on how I could represent that kind of idea.
Well, Chuck, I really appreciate too that you made your witch character from the past. She's not just some, she doesn't just turn evil and then that's it, you know? There's a kindness to her. I love the scene where the woman comes to her and brings her a little apple tartine and thanks her for the medicines that she gave to her mother. And you see that this is an important woman in the community, that she's helping people. She's using science. It may, I mean, there is magic that she wields as well, but she's using St. John's wort
And
and
to this day, homeopathic medicine is demonized. To this day, you still find that we're not allowed to do certain things. So for me, that was resonant as well.
Yeah, and she's attacked by the church, and you see I think that's something that resonates for right now too, though, is you see people get attacked and that it pushes them away, it pushes them out of the village, and then then it's nothing but war from that point forward, and
I'm glad
they
that.
become the villains of the internet, you know.
Well, I'm glad that was memorable that you're bringing it up, because that was one of my points, is not just to make the random ugliest witch I possibly could kind of a movie. I wanted to make the audience think a little bit, and I think it makes the scares better when you understand what the hell, what did she do to her spirit? Why was she so twisted for revenge?
Well, and when you're telling a witch story, it becomes very, easy to paint the church as the bad guys because they were doing very terrible things in that in that era, and they're not that they're not doing terrible things now, but that kind of ties a little bit. That's my stretchy way of tying it back to Stephen King, because
There
in
you
you have you you know anytime King has portrayed a religious character, there's a couple of notable exceptions, but for the most part, if a character is religious in one of his stories, they're going to end up going off the deep end at some point and
go. Don't
taking it
trust
too
that.
far.
Don't trust the church lady in any Stephen King story.
You got Miss Carmody in The Mist, you got Margaret White, there's pretty much there. I mean, even re recently, I just did a Silver Bullet screening and revisited Cycle of the Werewolf. The monster in that movie's the clergyman, and there's, yeah, I noticed that he falls into that quite a bit. It's a
It's hard to ignore it. I went to Catholic school as a kid, and it was a darker time even than in Catholicism. And it's hard to hear all those stories. The church's attitude now has changed dramatically, but in those days they were demonizing literally anybody who wasn't exactly Catholic. And I was raised in a Jewish neighborhood in Chicago, going, "Are you?" At 8 years old, I'm like, "Okay, you guys are lying. Friends are nice, and my dog does have a soul, so I'm just going to make it through grade school and try to keep out of trouble with the nuns." But God bless the people that mean well. But there's a big difference between structured religion and spirituality, including the belief in Christ and anything positive like that. The church doesn't own that. That's the reason they wrote those books, but the books were rewritten. You have to even watch out for all that. But trust your heart, reach for the light. And I try to put a balance, because I believe dark forces are real and not to be tampered with or taken lightly. But I enjoy dramatizing them in film as long as I have a sense of balance. I don't think you can dramatize darkness if it's just a movie about 100% despair. So that's why my movies perhaps are a little more entertaining and action-y in this genre.
Is that like a reason why you wouldn't fuck around with the Ouija board in this one? Is that, do you actually think that those can be portals, or do you just think that that's kind of like been done to death as a trope in horror?
Really, the reason I passed on Ouija board as an opportunity originally was it was too late in the Ouija board cycle, and I thought, but then I realized, well, I'm working on story notes on a pendulum board piece, And they're related because really
Right.
one did evolve from the other. The Ouija boards came after pendulum boards were outlawed, and they were developed into the early late 1800s, early 1900s. But the pendulum boards appealed to me as an art piece, and the versatility. They were spell casting. They were for fate. The whole divination element of pendulums goes back to finding water. There's a scientific reason. Scientists will tell you the whole micromotor element of holding that pendulum over the board means your subconscious is leading you, and it's a way you can get your subconscious mind to answer your own questions. Mystics will tell you it's the spiritual world. I think it's somewhere in between. It's just like tarot and everything else. It's a way of taking the pressure off your conscious mind and letting your subconscious fill in the blanks on interpretive symbols. So I really got into the symbology on this board, so I didn't actually summon any demons for real. Trust me, I didn't want to spend all day doing this and then, wake up with my eyes glowing red at night. So I was cautious to put ancient symbols I was familiar with that are can be interpreted as good or evil, depending on the practitioner.
Well, I think we need to start talking a little bit about some Stephen King stuff. We always ask what our guest Stephen King origin story is. So, do you have anything that jumps to mind the first time you clocked King as kind of a presence
Well,
in pop
I
culture?
must have read a short story or two, but it was The Shining that originally just blew me away. For the first time, I really said, "Wait a minute, this guy's a genius." I so loved the book that my first impression. I was one of those people who was like, "Wait, Stanley Kubrick went off the rails."
Oh,
No.
you and Steve are aligned on
Oh, totally. I'm
that.
like, "What?" I couldn't believe it. I thought they should have let me. Was I directing that? I wasn't directing yet, but I intended to. I was like, I should have done that. But honestly, the Kubrick film is genius now that I'm separate from my first experience with Stephen King. Just the elaborate, his internalization of how, for lack of a better word, I'll say magic and the supernatural work, based on the Jack, the I can only think of Jack Nicholson from the movie, but from the lead character of the book's
Jack
psyche.
Torrance.
Thank you. As a
Another Jack.
frustrated writer and a broken man going off the rails, it's just his genius to me is to take every man and the weaknesses and fallacies of human nature that we're used to and crossing it over into the supernatural in a be very believable way. And I think there's a very thin veil between what we think of as a natural world and the supernatural world. So I think we're all magicians. I think we're manifesting things in our lives. It doesn't mean it's a perfect world and we screwed up when bad things happen. Those are challenges, right? But I think that we're busy. Watch out for your karma if you're manifesting hate, which is what our witch does in witch board. But I think that there's a thin veil between the natural world and the human spirit and magic, what we call magic, and manifesting things in life. I think King's ability to illustrate that between the young son with a speech issue and the flawed father was absolutely stunning and made the whole piece very frightening and reinforced what I know about my own work in filmmaking anyway, which is if you care about the characters, then the scares are much more terrifying. In the case of his hero antagonist father, if you understand why he's broken, or what his issue is, he's even more frightening in that you'll know he'll never stop. In the case of The Shining, killing his own family. So these are very dark subjects that he has a way of humanizing in his work that I was like, okay, I'm a fan for life of this writer, and so I remained.
At what point did you, I mean, I know that Darabont was obviously a massive King fan, and you guys worked, creatively together, for quite a few films. And, was this, did you guys ever talk King amongst each other? You must have, because you're both horror nerds, right? So, you know a lot of
Correct.
stuff.
Correct. But it wasn't like fanboy conversations. The truth is, Frank had a personal relationship with Stephen, I think from when he was a student and did a short film. So I'd seen his
Yeah,
film.
he did The Woman in the Room, right? That's the one
Correct.
about
And
King's mother dying from cancer.
I was familiar with that. And I was familiar with the fact that Stephen King was a kind person. I had not met him myself at that point, but I thought that by extending himself to a student and to my friend Frank in particular, before I ever met Frank, that Stephen King was like actually a really good guy. He was a very successful writer. So I became doubly a fan of Stephen King from that.
Right. Did you have any, your chosen title today was Shawshank. You know, and I assume you're going to want to talk about the movie as well as the novella, possibly. Here, we didn't really sketch that out. Probably should have done that beforehand. Did you kind of have a front row seat to, you know, all that stuff going on? You know, because at this point, you weren't exclusively working together, but you did like have two bangers in a row with your collaboration on The Blob and Nightmare 3.
It's even a better story than that, to be honest.
Oh, yeah, please.
Let's hear it.
Let's hear
All
it.
Right.
Yeah.
We were actually writing something else. We were, you know, a good writing team at that point. And one of the studios, and I think it was Universal, was offering me a rewrite to direct, which I brought Frank in on at the time. But I knew Frank was ready to direct. We had a habit. We were a true writing partners. In other words, I've written with people where I've rewritten them, et cetera. With Frank, we on The Blob, we wrote The Blob before Elm Street, and we did that in my apartment when we were not working with a lot of money in those days. And
where was that? Was that in L.A.? Were you living out here?
Well, it was on the wrong side of the tracks, but it wasn't Beverly Hills, and it was on Elm Street, ironically.
Funnily enough.
Apartment on Elm Street, a second-story apartment, and Frank would come over and smoke his little brown cigars. And Frank Darabont is a sweet guy, a really brilliant guy, but very, also a very nice man. And we were very good friends. So the reason I picked Shawshank was because Frank came to me. We were in the middle of a writing assignment, and we had again gotten a cabin. In this case, we were in Park City randomly, getting a cabin there. We had rewritten Elm Street. We only had like 11 days to rewrite the script, but like a page one rewrite. And that was very successful. We got a cabin in Big Bear to do that. So here, this piece from Universal, we had a period of time to knock it out together. And we were at a cabin in Big Bear. And Frank said, I have to talk to you about something. I go, what, anything? And he said he had, I wonder if I'm telling too much. I wonder if Frank would share all this. Frank had gotten the rights to Shawshank from Stephen King for like a very small token amount of money. So it was, again, I think, a friendship issue between the two of them. I'd never even heard of Shawshank. I hadn't read it. At that point, I didn't know what it was, but I knew from him it wasn't horror. And Frank said he was about to lose the rights to the script because his time was up. And would I read it and tell him what I thought he should do? So I'm sitting in a cabin with a different writing assignment with a time skip pressure on that. And I read the script and I said, dude, you gotta stop everything and do this. It was not only was it a good script, I'm telling you guys, it was the best script I'd ever read in my life. I remember I hadn't read the novella at all, so it was a complete surprise to me.
Wow.
But that reading the script moved you to tears. Even before Tim Robbins and Morgan Freeman, which is like amazing casting and the best performances, credit to Frank as director. But the script was the, because Frank writes in a little bit of a literary style anyway. More than a lot of contemporary, since Shane Black popularized, I don't know if you know all Shane's work, but Shane popularized this super gritty one sentence form of screenwriting that's a super style of his. I was captivated by this story and I said, look, I'll finish this draft, which we were halfway through and was no problem. You go back to LA, direct this film, pay the dude the money, do not sell it to anybody. And he was offered big money. Frank had a very similar experience to Sly Stallone, who once shared with me after he wrote Rocky, he was offered a lot of money when he needed it to just sell it and let somebody else star in it and direct it. Frank had some people say, I love this script, let me direct it. I'm not sure if that's a story we're supposed to share.
Well, I think it's pretty known that Rob Reiner really wanted to direct it, and that he
I just told Frank, I said, this ship will not pass by again. He's capable of writing something else, but for a first-time directing theatrical feature, and I knew he would, I said, you will knock this out of the park because of the way you wrote it and how you wrote it.
Sounds like he vibed with the story already.
Oh, yeah. So that was a great... Listen, I love the film business, even though everyone hates the film business. I know why. But on the other hand, there's real magic.
Yeah.
There's, finding Cameron Diaz from the Jim Carrey movie, things that just are wonderful that pay off for all of us involved artistically and in the commercial side of filmmaking. So anyway, I was very happy for Frank, and I said, roll with it. And I was delighted that he stuck to his guns and got to direct it. That takes guts. So it's a good example for people are always asking me, how do I start in the film business? The real answer is, what story do you want to tell so passionately that you will find a way? And now you can add yourself shooting on your cell phone to it. We couldn't in those days,
Right.
you know. But that was Frank's passion project, and I was delighted at seeing him do it, and even more delighted that it's found its place in film history as a really great movie.
Yeah, it's a Pantheon title, and so much so that like it's kind of gotten a reputation here at this show, because we've been doing the show for 5 years at this point, and it's kind of got a reputation of like, well, what the fuck is there to say about this movie that isn't, yep, everything's perfect about it, right? It's like it's the perfect cast, it's the perfect score, it's the perfect cinematography.
Frank was so passionate about it. I knew he would accept nothing less. I'll bet he was demanding of everybody, as lovable as Frank can be, and it shows in the film. There's love in every shot. So that was my front row seat on of all the directors and other producers and people I know. That was a front row seat on a real success that was very hard to get made for the artist, and the satisfaction of seeing it. It didn't open that well. I was there on his opening week.
No.
It didn't get it. What happened? It didn't get its publicity or something.
I think people heard Shawshank and didn't know what it was. I that's a famous case of a movie that utterly bombed. I
I
remember
couldn't
being
believe it.
I remember sitting in an empty theater in Pittsburgh watching it.
I'm watching this movie and I'm like, am I crazy? Is it because I liked the script that much? I'm applying it to the film as well. The film took it to another level. Hats off to Tim Robbins and Morgan Freeman and the whole cast. And again, I honestly, I know it's all about Frank. How he did that was fabulous.
I got a question about some shared Stephen King DNA in the form of Jeffrey DeMunn, who
Oh
Frank has
yeah.
used a lot.
Yeah, well,
Jeffrey was your sheriff in The
yeah,
Blob,
no. You know, Frank
and
and I
did
were
you?
very close during The Blob, and he knows my whole casting project process. And we both love Jeffrey. He's super cool. And so I'm delighted Frank was able to keep working with him, you know?
Jeffrey was in he was one of the guards in The Green Mile.
That's
He was
probably my
in
favorite of the Darabont DeMunn things. I mean, he's really good, and of course, The Walking Dead was became a a giant character in that, but like I've rewatched The Green Mile fairly recently, and I think that's one that gets slept on a little bit now too.
He was in The
It's
Mist too, right?
he's in The Mist, yeah.
And he was in Storm of the Century, which is not Frank Darabont, but is Stephen King.
Yeah.
And I think he's read some of King's audiobooks. He's really nailed the Maine accent, so he's done that. I don't know, are there any I'm forgetting?
I think there is one. There's something I remember stumbling upon it. I don't remember what it was, but it was something random. It's like he pops up as a lawyer in, something that's not the thing that you would think about. It's like a thinner or something like that. Like I
We
remember going, "Oh my God, it's Jeff DeMunn."
come from su such similar roots. We've cross-pollinated other actors as well.
Yeah.
Michael Clark Duncan, who I saw in Green Mile, and Frank searched so hard to find Michael. God bless Michael's passed away, but
Yeah.
what a big-hearted man. And I think Frank recognized that and got that performance. Michael was a sweetheart, and I used him on Scorpion King
Right.
as best friend of Dwayne Johnson's character, and had an amazing time with two super big macho guys having fight scenes and stuff together. And I would just tell Michael, typically the way that for me to direct Michael anyway was like, Michael, you're a cello. Give me the low notes. Give me the whole heart. And he would just go for it. He was a wonderful for a person who, well, I believe originally was laying pipe in Chicago area. Really was a man's man and a wonderful guy. So I was, he passed away too early. I was sad to hear about that.
Yeah,
And
very.
also, Frank worked with Jim after I used Jim in The Mask on The Majestic.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah.
So we have had kind of similar backgrounds in loving some of the same actors.
And I would also, you got Jamie Campbell Bauer and Witchboard and Frank's
Yeah,
next
and
directorial
Frank
thing. He's doing
Costanza
Stranger Things.
is like,
So.
I'm like, you're kidding, because I had to shoot Jamie in a very brief period of time early because of Stranger Things.
Yeah.
Then whatever, the strike and COVID, and I could have used Jamie the whole movie actually.
Yeah.
But he finally got to shoot, and sure enough, Frank is doing two episodes that I can't wait to see. And Jamie's another. Wait to see. Jamie Campbell Bauer is going to be a huge star. He's a classic English actor. I believe Bauer can do anything.
Yeah. Yeah, no, he's getting this massive fan base too. Of course, you have the young women who find him very attractive, but you also, he's doing these weirdo performances. He's standing out. I love it when you have somebody that can be a leading man if they want to, but they lean into the character actor stuff.
You'll see it all from him, and in person he reminds me of like a young David Bowie. He's the real deal. He's a real artist. He was when we'd be with the rest of the cast on a weekend having a drinks in Montreal, Jamie would be by himself going to the opera. He's an very interesting guy. So you're gonna
Well,
see a lot of great work from him.
tell us about his character. This I don't want to give away too much, so I'm going to leave it on you, like, to share what you think people should know going in.
Baptiste is the untrustworthy expert. He's the untrustworthy occult expert in Witchboard. And if you want to have somebody explaining witches in your movie, there's nobody better than Jamie Campbell Bauer. He actually is very legitimately interested in the occult. And him and I would talk about how to, be care. I would basically, he owns Ouija boards and things I would never own in my home. Because I'm a big coward and I believe in the spiritual world. That's why I keep making films about it. I find it very dramatic, but I approach it very, very cautiously, where Jamie seems to embrace it. And he's a good man. I mean, the word occult, as his character explains in the film, only means the unknown, So it depends on how we choose to manifest things, whether it's through meditation or prayer or white witches with Wicca. I try not to judge. But even in my film, it's a cautionary tale because I use drugs a lot as a metaphor. I did it in Elm Street 3 with Freddy with needle fingers, one of my favorite images from that film. And we do it here with Madison Eisman's character, who's a recovering drug person. And I use her interest in the witchboard to be a replacement addiction. Dangerously addictive personality. And that's a real thing. I try to base as much as I can on the real history of witches, how witches might really have been, and how I see magic from my research as being a slippery slope. And how if you become obsessed with the dark side, it doesn't matter whether there are real devils and spirits. The human spirit is so powerful, you'll create your own, And I do believe in a spiritual world. Of good and evil side of it. So I'm trying to be cautious in how I dramatize it.
That's another level of connectivity between you and King. That's certainly a theme that he's revisited, and he's been very open about his own struggles with addiction and kicking the habit back in the 80s. And certainly The Shining, many of his films and stories are about addictive personalities and the fear that you could get transformed into something
I believe it's
that's
very
beyond your
similar.
control,
I believe it's very similar. I've had friends that I've had to help and brushes with it myself, but I already, I dropped acid back in the day in college. And when I, by the time I came to LA, I'm like, what are these drugs your people are taking? I can't sleep. You got drugs that make me insomniac, that you think are a big deal. So I was never invited to all the nasty parties because I was anti-drug, So it's a blessing in hindsight.
Right. So when you look at something like a Shawshank and you see one of these lightning in the bottles or your own personal experience with that effect, that's not something that you it's not something it's something you can hope for and plan for and put all the pieces in. But there is like an external thing that happens, a chemistry, a magic
Absolutely.
that happens with that. But I don't think it ever happens just totally by accident. You have to set all
No.
the pieces on there. But when you look at something like Shawshank, like in particular, like I made a joke of it earlier where I'm like everything fell into place perfectly and it kind of created, one of the most beloved films of all time and one that, if I look at any movie in the last, I don't know, 50 years or 40, say 45 years,
that stands a chance to be like a Wizard of Oz thing where people are still watching it in 100 years. You know, Shawshank's going to be up there, and there's just something where it, like, people old, you know, it's a dad movie, but also teenagers who watch it. I showed it to my my nephews, right, you know, when he was, I don't know, about 13, 14, thinking he was going to be bored out of his mind, you know, with it, because usually we watch horror movies and fun stuff, comedies. And he was engrossed in it. And so it's a thing that, you know, it's a movie that still resonates with people of all ages. So I guess the question is, like, you know, like, what do you think has to line up to make something?
That's two or three things. But it's the harder we work, the luckier we get.
Right.
So you're right. You can't always calculate it correctly. I've had a few number one hits, and some of them totally deserved it, and some of them were more timing when they came out. But the whole thing is a magical chemistry set. It's why film is unendingly fascinating, and worth the effort to me. Even when you start with this concept, I believe Shawshank, and maybe from in my own work, my best film still is The Mask. I think the audience senses an authenticity of what the French call the auteur, the author. In that there is one author. And while there are great studio movies, in my case, I thought Eraser and Scorpion King were really good movies, but they were my studio films where I was cooperating with a studio, with a movie the studio already wanted to do.
Right.
And while I'm proud of those films, I think Frank's Shawshank was so authentic to his passion, his writing, and his love for Stephen King. There's a reason for that. That it still resonates today. Also, there's a little trick you can do that I realized that is Shawshank is a period movie, correct? Period movie.
Right.
So they don't age as poorly,
right?
They don't age. And in my case, The Mask, I set it in a fictitious time zone in Edge City, and I didn't use the fashions of the day.
Yeah.
And sure enough, it's aged a lot better for a similar reason. So I think that's possibly one element.
Mm-hmm.
Why will Gladiator be around forever, you know?
Right.
That's how I look at Blade Runner and Gladiator for Ridley, or I guess you'd have to add Alien, whether it's sci-fi or period, sometimes those age better.
Right.
So it starts with the auteur, raw talent and passion that I think the audience sense authenticity. It's something that's very rare these days.
Right.
It's all of our entertainment, you and I were talking about the whole entertainment business earlier, as all of it becomes more corporatized and you serve more than one master. The work can be very entertaining and very good, but the audience's sense it's distilled a little bit, where these singular one-off passion projects tend to be more resonant. That's my vibe on the whole thing.
Isn't there an element of useful neglect, though, that comes as part of that? For a filmmaker to be the auteur, you can't have a studio system looking over your shoulder, second guessing every move, a producer who's telling you, you got to do this, you got to do that. And it sounds like with Shawshank, you correct me if I'm wrong about this, that Frank really, nobody knew him. The book wasn't a bestseller. Different seasons was, but the book itself wasn't so famous. It wasn't this iconic IP that everybody was fighting over. And he was able to make the movie that he believed and saw in his heart, right?
Frank is very stubborn in a good way.
Mm-hmm.
So I wasn't. He went off on his own, of course, to make that. I was, you know, rooting for him, and anything he wanted, he could have asked. But you got to go. You're like an astronaut when you direct a film. You got to go do it. So I don't know all the trials and tribulations he might have had, but it looked to me like he got enough support to make his movie. I know he made his own movie.
He made his movie, but the downside is when nobody cares enough to interfere, they also flub the release because they don't put enough effort into promoting it, right?
Fair enough.
Why aren't there so many stories of films that come out, they bomb, and then everybody goes, oh, It's a Wonderful Life, amazing film. Like, let's tell you, there's a lot of
versions of that.
Mm-hmm.
I was surprised to learn, because I'm a John Carpenter fan, and I met John a couple of times. I was surprised to learn The Thing didn't open.
Yeah, that's another example. Perfect.
The Thing supposedly bombed because it came right after, like, E.T. or something.
Mm-hmm.
In my case, my regret was The Blob because people always review it like it's too bad that's your one failure. I'm like, dude, they sold the studio. It was all new executives. They don't, the new executives do not want the old executives to have a big hit. It sounds counterintuitive, but it's a real thing. They don't want the people they replaced to have a hit. So my problem is the film's completed with one set of executives, a new set of executives comes in, and I'm looking at the ad campaign for The Blob. It looks like a piece of real estate being, you can't even tell it's a movie. It says The Blob.
What year was that? Is that 87?
I can't remember the exact years. It's all a blur, but
88, I think.
it's late 80s.
88.
Yeah.
Late 80s.
And the
And
studio was
I
Sony?
believe it was, I think TriStar.
TriStar.
I think
So that's
TriStar.
Columbia, right? Columbia,
Yes.
TriStar.
I guess so. So they traded hands, or at least the whole executive team traded hands. And they literally didn't advertise. They let it fail. And yet it's a beloved film for horror fans. And it's active. It's a you don't need a long attention span to enjoy The Blob, you know?
Well, and listen, the Blob, holds a special place in my heart, and as does Dream Warriors. I own a 35mm print of Dream Warriors, by the
Nice.
way. It's the
Wow.
first print. You
I'm
should
having a
come.
barbecue at your house. Let's put it
Yeah,
in the back.
come down to Austin, and we'll do a screening. I'd love to do that. What I love about those two movies in particular is that they just take your expectation of what they could be, and they somehow surprise you. It's like, the Jeff Dunham character's death in The Blob, for instance. It's something that if you're not really paying attention, you might go like, "Who is that?" Right? I mean, I know you do like a nice close up on the badge, so people, the cheap seats
Oh yeah. Well, I was
can
like,
understand.
how is
But
this not going to look like a whatever random digestion of the blob?
right,
So it's
right.
like a
But
movie.
also 35-year-old or 40-year-old spoiler alert to anybody who still needs to see
Right. Right,
the
but I still think it's an interesting, it's a choice that makes you perk up. It's that goes back to that auteur thing. You're being led through the story where you build up this kind of romance between Damon and the waitress, right? And then you don't see his death, and you reveal it to her in the phone booth. It's such a, I don't know. It just, I love those little touches. It's the kind of thing that sets Spielberg apart. It's those details. It's the thing that sets Stephen King apart. It's the character
One of
details,
the reasons that, not to be bragging, but one of the reasons the scare stuff worked in The Blob was as I just got the property, people kept asking me who would play the Steve McQueen role. So I thought, oh, perfect. That character will die immediately. In the first 20 minutes, the character you're led to believe is the Stephen King character in a Letterman's jacket at the time, is graphically blobbed. And one of the best things that Rex
I
ever
love
made.
that as a verb too,
You
blobbed.
are blobbed, and we had a lot of fun doing it. Tony Gardner, a lot of the effects team was really, really important to me, obviously, on that film because they were all physical effects and some brilliant miniatures and Hoyt Yates, people that went on to really become names in the whole visual effects and makeup effects world at the time. So whatever, that was a big adventure too.
Well, what is it, I know that, as a filmmaker now, when you're crafting these kind of, say in Witchboard, you're crafting, some gore sequences, you're crafting, horror sequences, and you have CG at your disposal. Like, when do you like kind of know when you want to go practical? How much of that has to factor into a budgetary concern and shooting days concern, and how much of that has to, go into, well, I also want to ground it. I want it to be something that, that people can relate to, because that's one of the great things about The Blob, in particular, is like I'm sure it took forever to get some of those shots, but there's a
The
visceral
blob
feeling about it,
was a real drama because the blob effect itself, the star wasn't showing up on the set for half the film, which caused the investors great concern. So I had to kind of call everybody I knew in the physical effects world and visual effects. We brought some wonderful talented people in halfway through because we were not getting the blob correctly. And so that was another big adventure to get it done. As far as Witchboard goes, it's the opposite for me. It's like not when do I use practical effects? It's like I'm using practical effects. When is it not necessarily possible to use practical effects? So basically, everything you saw, I think I could say this honestly. Everything you saw was a practical effect. I used CGI to enhance some of them. So the things I'm proudest of were the whole bedroom set And Madison Eisman's courageous performance, because she put up with all of that, and it takes courage. Practical, full-scale practical effects take courage, but one of the nice side effects of them is the cast is terrified because
Right.
they know they can trust me, but shit happens, right? So the time the bell rings and quiet on the set and those lights are up, it's weirdly lonely. You're on the set by yourself, knowing there's going to be an explosive practical effect, and they communicate a different kind of suspense and fear to the audience because it's slightly dangerous, maybe more than slightly. I make sure it's safe, but we built the entire bedroom set 8 feet in the air, so we can have real hands explode and grab her in real time. And those shots were as long of a shots I could do because we really made it happen on set. And Madison was okay with take two and three. She's quite brave, you know. Those hands are grabbing her in the bed seat, and the tub really a eternal tub. That wasn't split in two shots. She went straight down into the water, and those hands were real people with oxygen tanks on.
How is
We
that
made
accomplished?
really,
Is there like a trap door and under the murky water,
you
or?
know, I really there's a little bit of a Vegas magician in those of us that love practical effects. So, how can I create an illusion? While we use experts, a lot of time I've done it enough that I can tell you the basics and make sure it works with the experts. But I said, I just want a dump tank, like you'd see in a clown at the carnival. I just want something small enough for her feet. I'm giving, this is kind of a giveaway, but these things are in the trailer. I just wanted a platform, tiny platform just for her feet, so you can see the depth of the water until we pull the thing. Then you got to make sure she doesn't hit her head on the way down, because hands are really grabbing her and pulling her down. So it's quite a stunt. And Madison, went for the dunk, and it's very effective because it was really scary. Once again, you could see in her face, there's shots of her looking before shit happens, and she's waiting for us to pull the lever. So there's not a lot of acting required to help carry the tension. I mean, I'm laughing about it, but look, I'm really serious about my work. People do get hurt, and I didn't personally test that one, but I personally test a lot of them before we unless it's a stunt and I work with the stunt coordinator, So these are considered stunts up to a point. If they can be done safely, I want the principal actors in the mix, and we were able to do that in our film.
Have you kept up on King reading at all? Like, how much of King's work have you actually dug into on your own?
I was obsessive originally. I still love his short stories. He's so into small town America. There was one really good one that was very strange. What the hell was the title of it? Not too long ago, and they just made it. I just saw it again on television, on streaming. Outsider. Was it called Outsider?
Oh, the
Yeah, The
outsider.
Outsider. That was the last one I happened to have read fairly recently, where I was like, okay, he hasn't lost his fastball, you know.
No, that's King. There's nobody like King when you find one of his page turners. It's like Misery is one of those I found later recently to be that, where I read it in like two sittings, I think.
I
And I'm
haven't.
a
That's a good
world's
one.
slowest reader.
I've not read that.
That's kind of like Stephen King's take on The Sixth Sense. So it's like this kid that can see ghosts and what does that do? But he's a New York kid, and like, there's some really interesting rules
Well,
that come
no
with
one
that.
brings home the supernatural like Stephen King. I mean,
Right. Yeah.
the as well as he writes these unique but recognizable characters, and he's got a gift that's really, the floor of good writing, the basics,
Right.
which is his characters' dialogue are unique. In other words, you recognize these characters. They all have their own way of speaking, and you understand who Stephen means them to be. Whatever the archetypes are based on for him, they are recognizable archetypes. And when that character's voice pipes in again, you're familiar with the character. The writing that's a little more hack writing. You're just pushing your way through a plot, and the characters will all sound the same to me. So, as a writer, that's one thing I might notice while I'm reading, even something as immersive as King's work. I'll just stop and admire that that's the young guy talking to the mentor, and do we trust the mentor or not? It's going to be quite, you know, you can tell, you can tell you're in good hands on
Right.
page three of a Stephen King novel.
Right. Is there
Very true.
a King book or story that you would want to take a crack at as a filmmaker? You can say you can, hey, you're really good at reinventing things. You can do your own Shawshank. Say, Frank, you had your time.
Oh,
This is my time.
no. I never redo anything perfect. I mean,
Yeah.
the reason I did The Blob and even Witchboard was these were really cool, fun pieces of pop culture that needed a big improvement, a big
Right.
upgrade, and a reimagining. So I've been offered La Femme Nikita had a remake with an American title, and I'm like, that's Besson's like maybe best film to me. You know, I would never remake that. So I
Yeah.
have an attitude that the studios don't share on literally remaking things.
Right.
So I would be more interested in I really loved the Tower series,
Oh,
and
Dark Tower
I
stuff.
wasn't in a position to get in on that. I was shooting something else or whatever. So I lamented that the Tower was okay, but boy, that could have been great. That's
Yeah.
fantastic.
Oh,
If
yeah.
Mike Flanagan is now taking his shot at it, and we'll see if
Is
he
there
can
something
come
new?
up
Is
with
there something
something.
new on it?
Well, he's working on it after
Oh, good.
Carrie.
Good, great. Well, I hope he pulls it off and does a fantastic job.
Yeah, me too.
There was some news recently that King got into the trades, that King was reclaiming his rights to Shawshank from Warner Brothers, and that was interpreted by some of the trades as, oh, they're King is going to resell them and make a different Shawshank. I haven't spoken to King about it or to his film rep, Rand Holston, but my guess is if King is trying to reacquire the rights, it's got to be to preserve the movie rather than let somebody
Correct.
else. He's got to be trying to keep it out of Warner Brothers' hands, who might want to do like the Shawshank TV show or something.
That's much more likely because Steven's been in the mix long enough to have gotten, you know, elbow bumped, I'm sure, over the studio system. I want to say for the record, there are fantastic studio people. Mike DeLuca, who helped me get The Mask made as a comedy, it was supposed to be a horror film, but
Oh, really?
I believed I was inspired by Jim Carrey, and I said, let's make a comedy this time.
Yeah, the
There are
comic was
more.
way darker, wasn't it? Yeah.
Correct,
Yeah.
correct. And by the way, it'd be fun to go back to the original comic as a departure because Jim was very difficult after The Mask. He loved The Mask, but he was going through his I don't do sequels phase, which he then dropped later. But I think going back to the original comic is actually a super cool idea. So we'll see. I mean The Mask is wonderful. I consider it the best of my films, but I think the comic definitely leads you to like many more things that could happen with that character and that mask.
Well, yeah, no, I could see there being that track for sure. Well, Chuck, you know, we've had you for about an hour now, so I think we're gonna let you go. But thank you so much for joining, and I want to remind
Yeah.
everybody to go check out Witchboard when it hits theaters on August 15th,
August 15th, gang.
and keep your eye out for those remastering of of Nightmare 3 and The Blob. I can't and or
I
sorry, The
believe that
Mask. The Mask, yeah.
the Nightmare package, I think, is already for sale. I'm not sure when the new movies will come out, but they both look amazing. I mean, this is the wonderful thing about the digital world is you can really curate your work and make it really sing.
Thanks for joining us, Chuck. It was
I
great to
had
meet
fun.
you.
You guys are terrific. Anytime.
Best of
Well,
luck with Witchboard.
thank you.
The Kingcast is hosted by Eric Vespi, that's me, and Anthony Bresnikan. The show is produced by myself as well as Abby Goel and Tara Ansley, and is distributed by the Fangoria Podcast Network. Daniel Danger is our art director, and the show was created by me, the late great Scott Wampler.